So, since the last Matters of State, have you reflected on my hypothesis that Britain should solely, basically, have a navy, a very capable navy, with a sort of capable raw marine cannonball that can fire onto shore and a capable naval air arm that can just dominate the kind of littoral and blue water spaces?
To be honest, I have not. Mm. I did come across a tweet, though, earlier today.
Oh, yeah?
Saying that the reason why naval power is superior to air power as the kind of core endeavor of a country's military is because air power is always going to be about killing civilians indiscriminately. Like when you're attacking from the air, it's not going to be very precise. Really, it's going to come down to carpet bombing and blowing up buildings and blowing up markets and cars.
Is that true? I mean, I think that obviously the approach that NATO has taken has been to try and use precision munitions, hasn't it? Are you saying that if we ever came to a kind of a high-intensity kinetic war, that we would end up just using gravity bombs and that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we'd try and do it nicely, you know, until we ran out of the precision munitions, which would take about 10 minutes, mm-hmm. and then you're back to kicking barrels out of the back of helicopters.
Yeah, a la
and of course, that's just NATO, but most powers in the world are less worried about collateral damage.
Right.
And I think default thing when you're shooting a missile from an aircraft. Again, you also can't see it very well. Like, there's this hypothetical perfect scenario where you have, you know, one very bad guy in a building with no one around him, and you have the perfect intelligence, and you can send a missile in through the window, but that's not going to be a lot of your war fighting.
Mm. So I see what you mean. So sort of the default of air power is going to be indiscriminate area bombing. And that still is true today because the economic costs of maintaining precision strikes in a sort of high-intensity kinetic war is too high.
Yeah, exactly. But also the practicality. Like, where's a lot of war going to be fought? Probably not on the open plains. Again, what we see at the moment in the Middle East with Israel is, well, it's going to probably be in someone's capital city.
Mm.
And there, even being extremely precision, is going to knock out the next door flat, at the very least.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I can see that. I'm willing to sort of take that at this point.
Yeah, I mean, this is defending your point of view, because this is contrasted with naval power, which is much more strategic. It's about blocking communications. It's about breaking the enemy's will to fight, but at a much higher level. You're not doing it by killing people. You're doing it by starving them.
Right. Well. Well, I mean...
starving them of you know, the chromium they need or the ammunition they need. You know, not necessarily the grain
tungsten
they need.
And oil. And,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, the thing is that if you're going to stop the tungsten and the chromium and the lithium, you're also stopping the grain, aren't you?
Yeah, but I think it is much more common for a country, especially one that we'd be fighting a peer-on-peer war with, to be a bit more squared away with food essentials, either through storage or just having farms and things.
Yeah, I mean, in the near to medium term, I mean, the countries that we would be squaring up against would be, well, Russia, China. It's difficult to think of any others. You know, Argentina, they're probably not going to have a crack at the Falklands again anytime soon.
Yeah, they produce a lot of steak. They're probably self-sufficient.
Yeah, exactly. And so Russia could probably feed itself, I would imagine.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
And China, well, it probably wouldn't have to go overseas to feed itself, I'd have thought, if it really had to.
If it focused, yeah. But I think they have years of stockpiles.
Okay, well, I mean...
you'd chew through your ammunition very quickly. You'd chew through your oil very quickly.
Yes. I actually...
And also, most countries don't have every single raw material that they need. Like,
almost none do. I mean, pretty much the only country that does, I think, is the United States, isn't it? I mean, in terms of, it's got continental access to pretty much everything it needs. No, I mean, we don't know.
I have no idea. I mean,
I suspect the United States...
All the rare earth metals and lithiums and...
Yeah, there's a lot in South America, though, isn't there? So, I mean, it could get there if it really... Anyway, but your point is that sea power is more humane in a sense. It's a more calibrated, precise, strategic tool. Is that the implication of what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. It takes down the government and their warfighting ability without killing lots of civilians.
I would certainly agree in the sense that sea power is a much more total strategic weapon. Mm. I think that when you look at the history of the two greatest conflicts in the modern era, the First and Second World War, you make a pretty compelling argument that actually ultimately it's sea power that wins both. In the First World War, you know, the Royal Navy's blockade of Germany really is what brings Germany to its knees and ultimately causes the collapse of its government. Mm. And in the Second World War, really, again, it's the United States Navy and the Royal Navy in their control of the international sea lanes that allowed the Allies to bring their economic preponderance to bear in a kind of crushing...
Yeah, and I've heard it said that actually by the time we were landing at D-Day, it was already inevitable.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I mean, it's because fascinating, the actually. The yeah. Second World War is fascinating case in point because... anybody who's looked at the Second World War often wonders, why did Hitler open a second front against Russia when he, you know, in quotation marks, didn't have to? You know, he could have sat there in control of France, you know, Fortress Europa, and at the absolute zenith of his power, apparently at the zenith of his power. Mm. But the point is that Germany, the German war economy, was running out of stuff. The economy was overheating and running out of raw materials. He had to go east in order to feed the economy. He didn't have access to the materials he needed in order to maintain this kind of actually slightly ramshackle facade that he had kind of thrown over the continent. And the reason he didn't have access to that is because the Royal Navy was blockading the continent. And of course, it is ultimately Operation Barbarossa and the sort of that mad strike eastwards that, you know, you can argue led to
desperation.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, trade is a bit more complicated than putting a ship in the way. Like, it was a land route out you know, through to Turkey. One of the interesting things about the Second World War, I read, is the big challenge was needing foreign currency to buy raw materials from kind of neutral powers. Mm. So apparently, if Turkey hadn't traded with Germany during the war, they would have folded in less than 6 months because they just didn't have, I think it was chromium.
Mm. You need it for tanks, don't you, chromium? You need tungsten for tanks and artillery, I think. You know, chromium, I think it's tanks. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
If you want them shiny, yeah.
It doesn't matter. Yeah.
But the thing is, so one of the reasons why they got so obsessed with gold and that Nazi gold is such a thing and UBS's role, you know, the old Swiss banks, and why, yeah, they take gold out of the teeth of the, you know, murdered Jews, was they needed gold to buy the stuff to keep the war running because no one's going to accept their paper money. Mm. You know, Deutschmarks aren't going to get you very far in the wider world during the World War.
Yeah.
And so actually, yeah, even if you can trade, well, how do you pay for it?
I think that's fascinating. You know, as I grew older, yeah, I've always been interested in the Second World War, but as I grew older and I started to think about the war more as a kind of total global phenomenon, you realise that actually it's very little to do with sort of Stukas and Panzer IIIs and, you know, all of that kind of... the glamorized kind of kit that, you know, young boys get very interested in, Spitfires and sort of Crusader tanks and all that kind of thing. And it's much more to do with global economic systems than you'd expect.
You know, power blocks.
Yeah, things like shipping, you know, like how much shipping do you have and how are you able to use it and how does it interact with your air power and, you know, all of that kind of thing. And, yeah, how does it interact with your economy and how does that interact with your culture and, you know, and just all of those things. And you realise that actually, I think, you know, the James Holland, the sort of well-known contemporary historian of the Second World War, I mean, his argument is very clear that Germany was stuffed pretty much from the beginning. As soon as it refused to sort of make terms, basically after the defeat of France, basically at a disadvantage, it was stuffed. I think I think that's his thesis pretty much, that it was always inevitable as soon as the war didn't end at that point that Germany was going to lose. Which is a really fascinating perspective. I hope I'm not misrepresenting his view there. That's certainly the impression I've got from listening to him. But to go back to your initial point, this is the reason is, I think if you had to boil it down to one single reason, and this is my hypothesis, that really that is all to do with sea power. And sea power includes air power on water, as it were, or over water, rather. You know, sea power, air power is a subsidiary of sea power in this model. You know, it's what allows you to dominate the battle space out at sea. And obviously the air is a big component of that, as is the underwater space for submarines and so forth. I would lump all of that together as sea power. So I'm not just crudely talking about surface units. I'm talking about the whole sort of the whole integrated system for projecting force.
Oceans, two-thirds of the world's surface. So that's two-thirds of the world's battle space.
Exactly. And my hypothesis is that it's sea power that ultimately did it.
So, one bit of pushback. So you got your big aircraft carrier, very scary, very. But as soon as you're fighting a peer country, aren't they just a floating target? And just like one massive missile?
Definitely. In the modern era, I think that you can make a very, very good case that the carrier is not going to be the premier peer-on-peer warfighting weapon at sea. I think you can make a very compelling case that it's the nuclear attack submarine that is the modern equivalent of a capital ship, or the modern equivalent of the carrier in World War II. I would argue.
So a completely different model.
A completely different model. I think carriers are really, really cool and useful things, but they're cool and useful for they're not for your peer-on-peer battles.
Okay, so they're for dominating a small country you want to intimidate.
Well, the UK Defence Secretary has just recently said that the UK has, like many other Western nations, optimised for sort of operations rather than war fighting. And I think what he means by operations is these kind of limited deployments at our own time and choosing that are small in scale and as I said, limited in duration.
Yeah, they're definitely optional wars.
Optional wars. Away fixtures.
Existential.
Away fixtures. Yeah. And, you know.
Against the B team. Yeah.
Not quite friendlies, but yeah. And I think that the aircraft carrier is the perfect piece of kit for that. It's a really, really powerful piece of diplomatic kit because it's intimidating and it's kind of cool, and you can use it for humanitarian relief. It's a really, really effective humanitarian relief platform, so you know, it fulfills all of those roles. But I would say that the aircraft carrier in it, if you were going for a navy that had a lot of, should we say, top tier lethality, that top tier lethality is not mainly located in your carriers. It's in your missile platforms. And that your most effective missile platforms are probably your kind of advanced missile frigates and your nuclear attack submarines. And I mean, it's developing before our eyes. I mean, there's probably people that are thinking, oh, what about drones, you know, unmanned ship drones and things like that.
Well, exactly. Like, if you're saying, okay, we need to move away, it's not just the biggest ship that's going to win. You actually want more smaller, quieter things. And then that does take you down to the drone level, like actually as a swarm of tiny boats.
Yeah, I think that it's got to be big enough to launch, to launch things that have a punch. And it's got to be big enough to launch things that have a punch. And those things need systems that take up space. You know, they need radars, they need communication links, they just need the physical housing for things that are essentially sort of medium sized. Rockets. I don't think it'll ever get to the point where you kind of got a swarm of kind of tiny things, but a sort of distribute. I could imagine a world in which you might have a distributed missile frigate. So you've kind of got, you know, instead of one hull, you've got, say, six hulls that are all quite small, and each hull has a kind of combination of systems on it, such that they all work together, but there's also a little bit of redundancy, so you can lose one or two and you've still got an effective...
Yeah, okay, and one big missile doesn't destroy the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And maybe only one of them or two of them are manned, you know. I can imagine that being the case in sort of a couple of decades' time. But nevertheless, I think the essential point I'm making is that the lethality is still going to be in those units, and that the carriers will form a part of my kind of idealized navy.
Yeah.
But they're not the kind of the premier tip of the spear part. What do you think about that?
Yeah. So how much read across is there from the current situation in Ukraine where you got a whole load of cheap drones and they cost more to shoot down than they cost to build? So you're using 50-gram missiles or £500,000 missiles to destroy a, you know, £2,000 drone. Is there a risk that it's that on steroids with naval warfare, where you have all these, you know, missile frigates and nuclear submarines, which are, you know, extremely expensive bits of kit that have about 20 missiles on board. Each missile costs $2 million, and you're using it to take out very low-value targets that can be produced, you know, in mass at scale.
I think there's a massive risk of that. I think that, you know, as we started off by saying, we you know, we started this conversation by basically thinking about the economics of warfare, and that comes into blockade, the idea of a blockade. I mean, obviously that's a weapon of economic warfare. And then we talked about the Second World War and how really it's all about sort of economics and stuff like that at the end of the day. I think that's a massive part of it. I think that what I would say is that you can go, it's always an option to be asymmetric in your strategy, right? So one of the kind of prime examples of this would say be, you know, Hamas or Hezbollah in that we see in the current Middle East. They just have, you know, maybe even up to 100,000 rockets, which are all relatively cheap.
Yeah.
And they fire them at Israel, and Israel has to use this Iron Dome system, which is incredibly expensive, to knock them out because it threatens things that Israel really values, like the lives of its civilians.
Yeah, people. Yeah.
And so it's kind of forcing Israel to do that. The thing is that when you go asymmetric, you are ceding the ground to your opponent, right? And we see this in all forms of asymmetric warfare. You know, whenever there's a, you know, you think it's guerrilla warfare, basically. It's a form of guerrilla warfare. But the thing about guerrilla warfare is that you have to be willing to cede control of the ground in order to make it work. Because as soon as you start saying, no, I'm going to defend this patch of ground, your opponent will pin you down and they'll bring their preponderance of force to bear and destroy you. So you have to be willing to sacrifice the ground and to have mobility. And in return, the enemy gets frustrated because it can capture all the ground it wants, but it can't destroy you. And instead, you wear them down through that process.
Yeah.
Now, what that means is that if you are in the business, you know, if you're in the big boys league and you do want to be able to say, no, we are going to control this ground, you have to invest in the high-end systems. And that just does leave you vulnerable to this kind of economic attrition. But the quid pro quo is that if your enemy is just going to focus on that economic attrition, then they are going to have to cede the ground. And there's a political cost to that. And it's a political cost that nations who are, you know, the potential top-tier adversaries will be very, very hard for them to pay. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, and then you've also got the thing where asymmetric warfare works really well, you know, in mountainous regions and, like, on land where, you know, you can have guys hiding in caves and whatever, or jungles. But in the sea, you know, in the ocean, where do you hide?
Yeah.
And how do you sustain yourself? Like it's a hostile
environment. To hide in the ocean, you need an extremely Gucci bit of kit.
Yeah.
You know, it has to be a very, very sophisticated submarine to hide. And that's expensive.
The other way of hiding is being small, but again, you're in your little speedboat in the Pacific, and
you're also going to be far away from your base, and having something that you can control at that distance effectively means it's going to be expensive, as far as I can tell. It's either going to be expensive or it's going to be very vulnerable.
But what would you make of the Somalis, who are able to project force 500 miles off their coast in a little speedboat?
Well, what I make of them is that they're able to project force because we treat them with relatively kid gloves. I mean, what do? We, as the West, send, what, 2 or 3 destroyers on rotation a year, and we sort of treat them actually quite nicely.
Okay, so we could smash them if we wanted to.
I think we're choosing not to. Yeah, I think that's how I would interpret that, yeah.
I think that they're tricky guys. Someone was telling me the other day, there's this Royal Navy ship that picked up some Somali pirates, you know, just, again, like 500 miles from land.
Yeah.
And it actually picked them up and got them on the ship and took them down into the brig. And then a couple of days later, you know, they pulled them out onto deck to question them.
Yeah.
And so they've been, you know, even if they knew where they were when they got picked up, like, they've now been, deep in a ship for 2 days. They have no idea where they are. And the guy questioning them was like, so do you know where they are? And they said, yeah. And they got this map out. Like, you show us on this chart where we are. And they pointed to exactly where they were. Having just had a quick look at the sky, smell the water.
Mm.
And they just have this ability that we can't even imagine to navigate and know where they are at sea based on really subtle environmental cues. Like, again, here they were in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah, I mean, I find that very believable. I mean, the Polynesians colonized the Polynesian island chains with no compasses or any equipment that we would recognize as navigational equipment. And the theory is that they did it through precisely that type of seamanship, which is where you smell the water, you look at the sky, you feel the wind, and there are incredibly subtle environmental cues that tell you where you are if you're very, very familiar with them, which is amazing. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. You see, I guess
it's non sequitur because this isn't what we'd be fighting.
Yeah. And I still maintain that with the technological, I mean, that wouldn't be modern technology if technology was really brought to bear against them, with no ethical qualms.
But again, I mean, as we've seen, things like GPS are actually quite delicate.
Oh, no, that I agree with. Yeah. Yeah. I think that is the big question that I think all modern militaries actually will have to answer, which is that how do you harden those communication systems that link your forces together?
Yeah, so yeah, you got location, you got radio. I guess any computer, like we got to assume that even in the first few days of a war, like there's going to be electromagnetic,
It's interesting to look at Ukraine and Russia throughout this, because I think that Russia thought that they would be able to cripple Ukraine with their cyber in the opening phases. What they found is that they weren't able to do it, and it's interesting to speculate about why that was. I think that...
Yeah, if anyone's good at it, you'd expect the Russians to be good at it.
And if anyone's sort of bad at defence, no offence to the Ukrainians, they've shown them incredible, resilience and inventiveness and ingenuity, but you wouldn't have thought they would be the most prepared country on the planet, prior to the invasion for this sort of thing. They've been through political turmoil and they were defeated heavily in 2014. You wouldn't necessarily think, oh yeah, they're going to be top-tier cyber warriors. But yet Russia weren't able to do it. And I think that actually we have this mental model in our minds that the internet means that all things are connected to all things seamlessly. And therefore, as soon as you're in and you can wreak havoc. I think the reality is that, the connected systems within a country are fragmented and just as chaotic as you'd expect from something that
I think as anyone who's worked in tech would say,
yeah.
It's a lot less easier than you'd
expect. It's all held together with Pritstick and different coding languages and different and it's actually quite hard to, you can only ever attack one little bit. It's actually quite hard to get to there. I mean, there are no vital organs really. It's all just
fragments. It is attributed, isn't it? So my old theory that you'd know World War III has started because the lights go off.
I'm just not sure it's true, because I don't think there's one single system that controls the lights. But to go back to what you were saying about how do you protect the GPS systems? It's all incredibly fragile. There is one system that controls the Navy. Or at least there are very few systems, as I understand it, because when you're designing your very expensive bit of kit, you design it to work in a certain way. Now, maybe I'm being naive here. Maybe, military designers and planners have thought about all of this and there's multiple redundancies and they can use this system, they can use that system and blah, 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 blah. And I hope that's the case. But what one does wonder, if the enemy really took the gloves off and, say, started detonating EMPs in the atmosphere and things like that, would all of the kit really work?
Yeah, and has everyone been trained? Because, you can say you've got increasingly low-technology fallbacks and that, the ship's got a sextant on it.
Yeah.
How good are people using that stuff or the long-wave radio or whatever?
And on my kind of, that theoretical thing that I just thought about, the distributed frigate, six small hulls that all talk to each other and make up a more survivable and modular thing.
Yeah.
well, can you guarantee that you can maintain the connection between those different units? It's hard to speculate about, isn't it? But one, you kind of instinctively feel that that would be its Achilles heel.
I don't know, because, I mean, we say the internet's distributed and that's part of its strength and it's built out of these tiny pieces, but they do communicate with each other. And there's known protocols for doing this. You build an API, it's called, which is a kind of set of instructions for how a given application can be communicated with. And that can be quite robust.
Yeah. I don't know how...
How much information would be being exchanged between these hulls anyway?
Well, I don't know. I mean, presumably if you've got if you've got the radar on one hull and then you've got the kind of the weapon system on the other, that's quite a lot of bandwidth and data in real time that you're hoping to transmit. You know, if you're trying to guide a missile onto a target that's maybe hypersonic...
But that's between the hull and the rocket rather than the hulls on each other.
It could be between one hull with the radar on and another hull with the rockets on. You see what I'm saying?
Once the rocket's in the air.
Oh, yeah, once the rocket's in the air, it's only one, isn't it? Yeah, I suppose that's true. But regardless, one feels that...
into the specifics of an extremely hypothetical scenario.
One feels that might be its vulnerability. But to go back to Russia and Ukraine and with the drones, I think that what's interesting about that is that, of course, they're doing that to each other, right? So nobody's getting the kind of... the advantage from being the only one to be doing that, because they're both flooding the skies with cheap drones. And so therefore it's more about just the classic race between two industrial bases, who can ramp up their industrial base faster than the other.
It's with that, there's a bit of clever as well. And I mean, my favorite drones recently have been the wire controlled ones. And actually, this is probably the answer to you. How would the hulls communicate with each other? Well, you just put cables down. And that's really hard to disrupt. And so you now have the drones, a lot of them are controlled by cable. So you just have this little thin cable going out to the drone. And that can't be disrupted by electronic countermeasures. Yeah. And that's how rockets always used to be controlled. It used to be when you were shooting a missile, you have this massive spool of copper cable that would unspool behind it and it would be connected to the ground. And so you can just do that again.
Yeah, I think torpedoes still do that as well, don't they? I think they do, yeah. You just control them as they go out.
Yeah, I guess through the water it's probably a bit more difficult, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean...
So probably you can fall back on older technology and it's a lot less convenient.
I wonder whether you could fall back on direct laser technology as well. You just shoot a laser, communicate with laser pulses. It's just line of sight.
That's what everyone thought it would be, how things work now.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so to go back to where we started the discussion then, so is sea power a more humane form of strategic power than air power? Well, I think it's a much more powerful and a much more... yes, it's certainly a more powerful and totalizing force. And what by totalizing, I mean that I think that you can bring about the strategic defeat of your enemies much more comprehensively and much more quickly with sea power than you can with air power. And to that extent, it implies less collateral damage because of the reduced need for total destruction.
Yeah. And so, it's realistically, everything is going to be transported by sea. You just can't transport that bulk by land. So even if you are fighting a country that's in a continent with good land links, that's not going to be how you're moving your coal around or your iron or your grain.
Yeah, and also, there are lots of... one assumes in the modern era that there are lots of scenarios of kind of peer-on-peer conflict that don't necessarily involve the kind of full-on invasion of the enemy landmass and actually a more kind of, not low intensity, but...
A Cold War, if you will.
Yeah, where actually you want to threaten the enemy with consequences that are relatively low. You know, you have a low-cost option to produce high consequences for your enemy and not have that mirrored. And actually, sea power is the perfect choice for that, Because if you can say, if you can credibly threaten to your rival, oh, we can close down the sea lanes, yes, maybe theoretically they can survive, keep the economy going, keep the population fed, keep the military supplied. But it's going to be really, really difficult while you yourself are only suffering the expense of maintaining your fleet, which you kind of do anyway. So it would be a strategic pressure lock that you can put your enemy in, and it stops short of bringing about their collapse or defeat, but it's nevertheless something for them to really think about in their strategic calculations.
Yeah. On his signal. It's like,
yeah. I think as well, it's worth thinking about, right, going back to, well, is it a more humane form of power? And I'm not quite sure what I think about this in my mind, but you could think about it as the difference between the First and the Second World War, right? In the First World War, Germany didn't have to be invaded. The blockade was kind of total. It didn't have access to any of the resources in the East or the West. And so the government collapsed and nobody had to invade Germany. Germany was more or less intact in terms of its, you know, in terms of its physical assets. Mm. And yes, some people were starting to starve, but there wasn't actually mass starvation. There wasn't mass death from starvation.
Yeah.
It was the prospect of mass death from starvation that collapsed the government. Whereas in the Second World War, where Germany did have to be invaded because the incredible strength of the ideology meant that, you know, even when the writing was on the wall, they refused to surrender. Mm. You look at the scale of civilian destruction in the Second World War in Germany versus the First World War. I mean, it's just a many, 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 many multiples.
Yeah.
So there you can see the difference between defeat through sea power and defeat through land and air power. And definitely defeat through sea power is preferable.
Yeah. But what were we saying? There was sea power in both? Or?
Well, there is sea power in both, but my point is
that... Did sea power fail in the Second World War?
No, sea power was what enabled the Allies to bring their overwhelming force to bear and to have their economies and militaries linked. But in the Second World War, because Germany was able to gather so many resources from the lands it conquered on the kind of Eurasian landmass, combined with the fanaticism and zealotry of the Nazi ideology.
Plus going in prepared, or at least knowing that this is a problem we're going to have to solve.
I mean, arguably, Germany should have surrendered in 1943.
Mm.
You know, once it had been kicked out of North Africa and defeated in Tunisia and things were going wrong, you know, they were no longer advancing on the Eastern Front. Arguably, that is the point where they should have sued for peace.
Mm.
Because at that point, yeah, it's all over. But it was the strength of the Nazi ideology, the zealotry. I don't mean strength in a positive sense. I mean this. I mean the fanaticism that didn't allow that to happen, and that's why it had to be, you know, literally pounded to dust. So it wasn't that sea power didn't work. It's just that no instrument.
You needed to go in and deliver the coup de grace.
Yeah, no instrument is the perfect instrument, but sea power allows you to defeat your enemy.
Because this was my next question. You know, you're saying that. British Defence Secretary was saying that, UK can no longer actually fight a war. It can only just do limited operations. Does your vision of having a massive navy and purely focusing on that, does that address that? Does this count as fighting a war, or is this still just operations and...
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, when you think about it, what does Britain fighting a war look like? We have never, ever invaded a continental power without allies, I don't think.
I mean, invaded most. Era. By power, you mean like something legit.
Well, yeah, like as in.
And aren't there like 9 countries we haven't invaded at some point? And I'm sure we didn't have.
What I mean is that, say a European, a peer power, we have never mounted an attempt to defeat a peer power on land without our own land forces being in the minority of the overall effort. I'm saying this in a very complicated way. We've always used allies to fight on land, right?
Yeah.
You look at all the wars
we've always allied with land power.
You know, the last time that we tried to fight on land alone against a continental power was, I don't know, what, the campaigns of Henry V? And yeah, we won some amazing battles, but strategically, it was a complete disaster.
Yeah, 100 Years' War. We normally lose interest after the Agincourt bit.
Yeah.
nothing more to see here.
It ended in 1415. you look at the Napoleonic Wars, and we just used Austrian and Prussian and all of those armies to do our fighting for us on land. Basically.
We did our bit and often led by example, but in the World War, standing alone, but we didn't actually do any fighting on the land during that bit.
The British Army's contribution to the campaigns in the West was very significant, and the holding the Japanese back in Burma, very significant. But ultimately
it was a minor piece.
The fighting and dying on land was done by the Russians and the Americans.
Yeah.
The point is that those efforts by the Russians and the Americans could not have been coherently linked up and brought to bear without control of the seas. Mm. And that's what the Royal Navy, the bulk of that was actually provided by the Royal Navy. Not in the Pacific, that was done by the Americans, but every other ocean, it was the Royal Navy that was doing the lion's share of the heavy lifting. So what I'm saying is that in any war that we would be fighting against a peer, we would be relying on being part of an alliance.
Okay, so you're saying that we're only ever going to be called to do operations, like we're never going to be fighting a war on our own.
I think that what investing in sea power would allow is that if we did end up in a war and we also catastrophically ended up alone, it would allow us to survive.
Mm.
Because if you've got a decent navy, you can't be invaded. And we are surrounded by water. Perfect.
Yeah.
So it gives us a kind of minimum survivability, which says that Britain could not be invaded, which means we could hold out. And that's basically what happened in the Second World War. We were knocked back to the absolute, geostrategic worst case scenario.
Yeah.
Which is just Britain and its empire alone with no allies for like a year. And we were absolutely fine. There was no point at which we were actually in danger of invasion.
Mm. And then your other point is kind of that it also makes a war less likely. Like, we don't want to fight a war. Like, no one wants to fight a war. It's a terrible idea.
Yeah.
And that by having naval dominance, you very much reduce the odds of a war happening.
Yeah, because your enemy has to really, really think about the fact that they're going to have their access to the seas cut off. That is not a trivial prospect for anyone. And it gives you all of those advantages, being able to optimize in a particular domain and have overmatch and all of those kind of things. There we go.
Did you ever want to join the Navy?
I did. I did want to join the Navy.
Why didn't you?
It was because, I guess it's two reasons really. I grew up without much money, and I was offered, before I could join the Navy, while I was in the process of the kind of quite lengthy selection process, I was offered a very well-paid job, and I found that very difficult to turn down at the time. Obviously, that was a terrible decision. but at the time, it was very powerful. And to be honest, that was the main reason, actually. That was the main reason. Which is so foolish when you look back at it. Especially given that I hated that job and I was out of it.
You did not enjoy that job.
within a year. Just the prospect of somebody giving me money sort of next month rather than in sort of 8 months' time, or whatever the selection process, whatever length it would have taken, was very, very seductive and powerful at that time, because, I'd spent so long without, worried about money and not having access to it. And I think, genuinely, that was probably the biggest reason. Yeah. Mm. If you ask me, do I regret it? Yes, I do regret it. Things have turned out fine since then, and I don't regret
Yeah, the counterfactual is quite hard to work through.
It is quite hard to work through because, you know, life is good now. It has been for a long time. But do I think that it was the wrong decision at the time? Yeah, definitely it was the wrong decision not to do Navy. Yeah. Did you ever think about joining the forces?
Yeah, I mean, well, like you, I suspect that having joined the army would have been a better start to my career than becoming a trainee accountant. I think it just actually sets you up really well for life, and so that'd be my advice to anyone. Mm. Uni, then Sandhurst. Not the Navy. Interestingly, because there's quite a lot of Navy in my blood. My great-grandfather, he was a captain of Q ships during the war.
Oh, yeah, very cool.
So they were the ships that... It would look like just a standard cargo ship. It would sort of drive into the middle of the enemy's harbour. Then suddenly they'd whip all the tarpaulins off and it's covered in guns. It would lay waste to the place and then kind of reverse out. And that was his job. He had a magnificent beard.
It's quite a piratical job, that one.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you've got to be a bit of a nutter.
Yeah.
And he was. I think at one point he was on an ocean liner, I think, you know, coming back from South America or something, and had a disagreement with the crew and ended up taking it over. I don't know the details.
As in, he took over the ship?
Yeah.
Alone?
History doesn't relate.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, very good.
But anyway, there's a lot of that. A lot of Merchant Navy in the family. My uncle, he drove banana boats.
Very good.
Is drive the right word?
I don't know.
Second officer.
I think you drive a boat.
Yeah.
You sail a ship.
These are ships.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. In my family, it was my great uncle. One of my great uncles was captured by the Italians, and then the Navy sank the ship that he was on, being held in captivity on. So sadly, he died. There was another one who was in the Merchant Navy and survived the war, but was clearly very traumatized by it. So he
yeah, that was a intense job. Yeah,
he never spoke about it. He was given sort of therapy. He used to do his woodworking, but he never spoke about it. And there's sort of some family stories about how, you know, the things he saw, you know, people being machine gunned in the water and stuff like that. And yeah, just very unpleasant.
Yeah, being in those convoys.
The convoys I think were very, very gnarly.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it's all there in our history.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a huge part of what we are as a country, how we see ourselves. Like, every moment in our history has been, the Navy's been there as a factor.
Yeah.
You know, what started the Civil War? Well, it goes back to ship taxes to defend our coasts.
Yeah, all the way back to the sort of the 11th century. Yeah. But this is the final thought then for this. I think that the UK, and you've pointed this out, actually, that the UK is in a malaise at the moment. You know, its animal spirits are low. You know, we've lost a sense of belief in ourselves, a sense of confidence. You know,
yeah.
The wind is out of our sails. I mean, I think that introducing this idea of a national project of rebuilding our Navy and maritime heritage, I think it'd be the perfect shot in the arm for the whole country.
I think I think, like, anything would be good. Well, one of the reasons why I think Boris Johnson was so successful as a politician was he was able to kind of communicate these visions. I think his idea might have been more his advisors, or was to, you know, create, you know, the Athens of the North Atlantic and become a real center of scholarship. And it was just this vision that you can get excited about and get behind, and people can work towards, and people can turn down the high-paying job to just get involved in this because it's so exciting.
I think that's right. And, you know, I don't know how I would have, if I would have made a different choice, had there been a kind of convincing story and narrative sort of in the air, in the culture, you know, all those years ago when I was making that decision. I have no idea. But I think enough people would make a different choice.
Yeah, but also really... it brings dignity to jobs that are currently quite low status. There's a story once, I forget which president, was on a tour of NASA's facilities during the Apollo program. And there was a janitor, you know, sweeping the corridor, and he says, "Oh, what do you do?" And the janitor said, "I'm helping put a man on Mars." With enormous pride, he felt part of this effort.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was really powerful. And you can see that in modern companies like SpaceX, where there's there's a real sense of mission. Everyone's actually really excited, and people will make sacrifices to be part of that.
Yeah, you got to believe. You got to believe in the aim, believe in the vision, and it's a banal point, but it's also a really important one. I think that it gets lost that it's sometimes in the modern world, which can be quite technocratic, and you know, it focuses on sort of optimizing outcomes and theory and all of that kind of thing. You miss the element of...
It's a mathematical problem.
It's a mathematical problem, yes, but exactly. Whereas actually...
Yeah, it shouldn't be, is it?
If you really want to produce better outcomes, you have to get people to make sacrifices. Mm. I think that that is a really, really key and fundamental insight, because if people are not willing to make sacrifices, then the whole kind of community effort, which is what any economy or nation really is, doesn't work quite as well as it should. It doesn't work efficiently. People have to be willing to sacrifice their own interests in the
greater good. But again, what is your own interest? Because what you're sacrificing is maybe 20% of salary. I mean, what's money for? Money is for bringing you joy. And if you get joy without the money, then you're saving some steps.
But that's the amazing paradox, isn't it? That's the insight that is actually at the heart of this whole thing that we're engaged in, which is social cooperation. Mm. Is that, you give up something, your freedom, your ability to do whatever you want, whenever you want. But what you get in return is actually so much more powerful. Mm. But the point is, it's always in the future. You're always giving up now for something that's much better, but in the future. And it's that key insight that sacrifice for a better future is the way forward, which is so powerful. But to motivate people to do that, you have to tell them a really powerful story about the future.
Yeah. Well, and give them confidence it exists.
Yeah.
Because again, like your high-paying job is also investing in the future. It's if I keep doing this for a few years, I'll be rich. Oh, great, but
yeah,
what does that mean?
Yeah, it's all to do with values and ideology, isn't it?
Yeah,
and you have to communicate those through narrative. But it's not just a narrative. The narrative also has to dovetail with what is feasible and possible in reality. It has to push the bounds, but also be realistic. And it's that kind of heady,
tangible but exciting.
Yeah, it's that heady combination of combining the poetry of the vision with the prose of the practicalities. If you can suddenly bring those two things together, then it's incredibly powerful and we can achieve amazing things. And so you have to think, the best politicians, they're able to do that. They're able to have a vision. They're able to see that it is practicable, and they're able to weave that story and bring the nation with them. And then amazing things happen. And I think that at the moment, I'm not saying that rebuilding the Navy and that kind of national project is the only way that this could happen. Of course, there are lots of different stories that you could tell about for Britain to get the wind back in its sails, and I'm sure we will eventually, because we're very lucky to have lots of options. We have lots of different strengths, but I think that this one would be a really good one that would not only benefit us but would benefit the whole world with additional security, stability. I think trade. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's ironic that the new Labour government, they're obviously very technocratic, and some of their analysis of what the problems are not a million miles off. They want to increase defence spending. They understand that we need to be able to fight a war. They understand that there are all these different things that need to be fixed. But the element that it seems to me that they are really missing is that understanding that you have to give people the animal spirits, as you might say, an economist might say, to actually make the efforts and the sacrifices to get there. Because otherwise, nobody pulls together and it doesn't happen.
Yeah, what was that saying from, was it Anton de Saint-Exupéry? The guy who wrote Le Petit Prince, French writer, who said that if you want to build a ship, don't just organise people to cut down trees and nail stuff together. Instead, just communicate a longing for the sea, and they'll figure it out.
yeah, that's so right. I think with the United States as well, I think that people often wonder, but certainly Europeans often wondered, like, how on earth can Americans be attracted to a figure like Trump, who to many kind of sophisticated in quotation marks, people on both sides of the Atlantic, seems this kind of grotesque kind of figure. Well, what I would say that the secret to Trump's success, from my perspective, is his ability to just tell this story, to tell a narrative about America and where it is and what it is and where it should go. And you can agree or disagree with that story, and I'm certainly not claiming that I agree with it, but it's still a powerful story.
Yeah.
And that is why he appeals.
Yeah.
Because he gives people a sense of, if we elect this guy, we will have a direction.
Yeah, and actually it's a classic case, isn't it? Because, yeah, on the spreadsheet he looks far worse. You know, rationally, or, you know, you think, okay, how do I make the most money in the next 5 years? So, you know, he's far worse. But it's exciting.
I think that, you know, if the Democrats, if they really want to slay this dragon, and they really do believe that they are, you know, the saviors of all that is good and decent in the world, which is what they do seem to believe, they've got to stop, you know, playing that reactive game of just saying the other guy is terrible. You've got to start telling a convincing story.
Yeah, what's your story?
Story that they've been telling about, it's basically about, I don't know, what is it? It's about writing past injustices.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, we are sinners. Yeah, we're all sinners and we need to redeem ourselves.
Yeah, it's all about the past, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's all about all these things have been terrible and we're the kind of the moral, we are the sort of penitent prayer, you know, vote for us as a sort of penitence for all these sins of the past. I'm not saying that there weren't sins in the past or that there weren't terrible things that need fixing. I'm not saying that at all. But the point is that as a narrative, that backwards looking one is a lot less powerful than the forwards looking one. And that might be why, despite on paper Trump being terrible and on paper the Democrats being, you know, average, is that Trump is running them really, really close and, you know, may well win.
Yeah.
You know, why is that? Well, it's because he tells a better story.
Yeah, which would you follow into battle and why?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, interesting reflections.
Yeah.
I hope.
Yeah.
So stupid reflections, maybe.
You can have stupid reflections as well.
Yeah, I mean, what do we know? We're Europeans. We don't know anything about Trump or Harris. I think that, Americans must get really wound up by Europeans weighing in on this. I mean, so apologies if you're...
Well, I get a bit wound up by Europeans feeling they ought to weigh in.
It's
a foreign government far away. To what extent does it affect me?
Kind of affects us. I mean, you know, we are basically an American auxiliary.
Well, that's the problem. It affects us because the mood music then comes over here and all our politicians think they're American. And so we end up arguing the same debates, but less well.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, everyone gets really annoyed about abortion rights. I mean, it's not really an issue here.
No, I mean, we've had consensus on abortion for the last 30 years.
Yeah.
If not 40. Yeah. But, I mean, you know, functionally we are an auxiliary of America.
Yeah, someone's wondering if we should just own that.
I think we should just own it.
There is a vision of just uniting the USA, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, UK. Why are they different countries? Inefficient. Just make it one country.
Yeah. You can kind of have a federal system.
You can still have
a government based in Westminster. But
yeah,
it's fine. So there you go.
That's even more extreme than focusing on Navy.
Yeah, but then, you know, you focus on Navy because that's the obvious thing.
Yeah.
You know, if America had a state just off the coast of Europe in the North Atlantic, what would it use it for? It would use it for Navy.
Yeah.
So that's why.
It's coherent.
Yeah, it is coherent, yeah. You'd use it for Navy and for, you know, long-range patrol kit.
Yeah, and for vibes.
Yeah. You probably base some nukes there.
They do already.
Medium range. Yeah. Yeah, they do already. Exactly. Well, there we go. We've solved that then. Any final thoughts? Did I answer all your questions about drones and Ukraine and the humanities of the humaneness of sea power and
I think so. I think we got a lot into the weeds of the details of how a hypothetical future naval combat system might work.
Well, I liked that.
It was fun, but
we didn't even get onto like distributed submarines.
No. Save that for next time.
Yeah. Masters of State 3.
Yeah. Distributed submarines.
Yeah, distributed underwater systems.